All right, hello and welcome. I'm Alex Dunneman, and over the next year, I'm going to be conducting interviews with the directors of shows that go up here at the U of A. So today, I'm joined by our first ever guest, Susie Martin, who's the director of God's Ear by Jenny Schwartz. You want to tell us a little bit about yourself, Susie?
Sure, yeah. I'm just finishing my program, obviously. I come from Winnipeg most recently. I guess I was born in Ontario and grew up first half of my life there, and then second half of my life in Winnipeg, and now the third half of my life is in Edmonton. And I came here 2 years ago to start school, and what I guess what brought me here, as most people I think who come to theater, I started out thinking I wanted to be an actor, mm-hmm. and I did an undergrad in acting at the University of Winnipeg. They don't have a directing stream there. They have one class, which I took, and it was sort of like, oh no, this changes everything. And then I spent a couple years sort of figuring out which I wanted to focus on and doing some assisting and doing some of my own producing and directing through the Fringe. And just more and more realized this is where I want to do my thing. And I've had the good fortune of making my living in theater since I graduated, working in admin and producing and stage management and the whole deal. So out of all of those things that I've tried, directing is definitely the thing that feels most like where my talents and interests lie, and being here for the last couple of years, I feel like that has really, really cemented for me.
Yeah, that seems like a common path too. People in theater seem to do all of it, like to make a living. Sometimes you gotta put your hand at everything.
You gotta sort of diversify. And I was working as a stage manager as a sort of while I'm trying to, you know, make a living and figure out my life. And then I realized if I was serious about that, I was going to have to hustle just like anything else. And I thought, if I'm hustling, I might as well be hustling for the thing I really want to do. So I think it's time to go to school and make it happen.
Exactly. Excellent. Do you mind giving just a little brief rundown of the play?
Sure, yeah. I guess it's not super heavy on plot, but but the central event is that this couple's 10-year-old son has drowned. Suddenly we start with them at the beginning while he's in a coma, and then pick up in scene one after he's died, and time and space are pretty nebulous in the play, so we go on this journey with them. But it's a beautiful thing because it's not just a realistic, like, oh, let's sit in the sadness of this thing and have this sort of linear narrative. It ranges all around and touches on a lot of absurdism and the encounter. For me, it's about the encounter with the unknown and the unknowable, and that sense that, which I think is underneath all grief, whether great or small, is this dissonance between what we had the world as we expected it to be and hoped it would be versus how it actually is. And that gap, I think, is where this play lives. So there's surprising things that happen and jarring things that don't fit into what you expect to be a sad play about about a grieving family.
Kind of the antithesis of Rabbit Hole by... That sort of absurdist take. That's very interesting. Cool. So what was it, on your first reading of this play, or when you kind of first found it, what was it that drew you to it? Was it that absurdist nature?
Language is almost always the way that I come to a piece. I've directed, since being here, I've directed some Pinter twice, Sarah Rule, and Oscar Wilde. So language heavy in different ways, and despite the stylistic differences of those pieces, that was always the way in for me. And this one was no exception. It's really beautiful on the page. She's arranged the text to a kind of poetry, and so it already sort of draws you into this, we're not in realism, something else is happening here. And then it's, surprisingly funny and strange and all those things. And I think for me, there was a feeling of recognition, because I have dealt with some major grief in my life. My dad passed away when I was 16 very suddenly. And so that's like 14 years ago now. 14 years ago, next Monday. But that recognition of, oh yeah, that's the feeling of sort of the trying to stay okay on the surface while everything else is going on underneath, and that strangeness, that absurdity felt right to me as well. And so I really appreciated how unsentimental the play is. That sort of fragile matter-of-factness that is that experience of going through grief. So it was recognition and then also the stylistic challenge and delight of that for me that sort of was a perfect...
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, because sometimes that absurdism can be even more powerful in displaying a message. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen Anthony Nielsen's The Wonderful World of Dissocia, but it's a similar play where it takes this dissociative disorder, but it sets it in this crazy world, this like almost Alice in Wonderland type world. Mm-hmm. And you can identify it almost easier because of the fact that it is so absurd. You're living in that person's head instead of seeing them from the outside, right?
Yeah, and this is a play where the figures of speech become reality, and like they sort of call their world into being by the things that they say, and so it works a lot with the way that we sort of hide in language, or we try to use language to bridge a gap that it can't bridge, and the thinness of the language comes out, which is I think something that the absurdists really understand, that the brokenness of language, the brokenness of the world, like the whole world is sort of broken, and what do we do with the pieces that are left? And that's really what this production is about for me.
Yeah, that's excellent. So working with stylized language like this, how do you kind of approach that process?
Yeah, that's a good question. This play is really about, quite meticulous line by line. Because when you work with a text that's poetic and bizarre in whatever way, heightened in some way, there's just the joy in the language itself, and I also have an English lit background, and so part of me just loves that. I'm like, let's just speak this poetry and how beautiful, but then to keep it active and specific and like, why are they repeating this line over and over and over again? There's a rhythm to it for sure, and that is pleasurable or takes us somewhere, but tactically and keeping that really grounded. I always try to think of everything like Shakespeare in a way, because people are prepared to do the work for Shakespeare and to think that, you know, there's more in the language than meets the eye, and it's really about phrasing. And so, what is the long tie of the phrase? Well, there's all these little short sentences, and then how do we turn corners within that? So it just is a lot of meticulous work that way, I think. With this one, the rhythm of speaking quickly and thinking on the line is something that Jenny Schwartz talks about in her introduction, and that's a challenge because there's a lot going on underneath, and right now in this process, in rehearsals, we're really digging at what is actually going on, right? So you have to sort of slow it all down and space it all out to find all the bits and pieces, and then we're sort of going to have to be in this process of what I've been calling glazing, of covering it, you know, covering it over again, because they're sort of trying to stay on the surface of the thin ice. And I think there's this drive through the thought, almost like they're ahead of their own thoughts with their words, and then have to deal with the repercussions of what they've said.
Super interesting. Yeah, that's something I've seen in a lot of works. It's a lot of the absurdist work sometimes feels like doing Shakespeare, where you have to read underneath the lines, kind of understand it. And there's been a lot of work even recently or contemporarily on language and how sometimes it's not what the word's saying, but how it's being said and how that can affect you in an emotional way. So
totally, and it's not just it's not just at face value. They're not just having a casual conversation. I mean, in real life, we rarely do either, but we feel like we are, and to just know that there's intention underneath that, and there's motivation underneath that, but there's also this other formalistic thing over top. So there's sort of two directions to go with it.
That's really interesting. It's exciting too to see contemporary work that hasn't, at least I hadn't heard of the play before it's coming here. So what do you think are some of the kind of benefits of working on contemporary work like this?
I don't know. Like I haven't given it a ton of thought in terms of a huge mandate around that, I guess. But I think for me what's interesting is everything that is now is building on everything that's gone before, right? There's nothing new under the sun. So to take a play that's right now, first of all, it just broadens the gene pool, right?
Yeah.
So if we do a Canadian premiere, then we get to see a show that no one's seen before, you know. And that's great. And it keeps us in touch with what's going on elsewhere in the world to do that. But I think we are living now. So doing work that's now that touches all these other things. That's what I like about this play, is that it doesn't, it's not just now in the way that like a TV show is now, where it's very of the moment, but this is touching on other movements that have gone before and other ways of thinking it, and then remixing it into something that speaks to us where we are right exactly now. And I think that's really exciting. And I love to see theater that is contemporary, that isn't afraid of doing something larger aesthetically, and I think I don't think that that's necessarily a novel thing. Like, I think there's lots of really exciting theater being done, but it's lovely to see something that moves beyond realism, but isn't just moving beyond realism as a sort of sticking it to the old man of realism, but actually trying to tap into something else.
Yeah, it's trying to still tell a story, even if it's in this kind of heightened world, right?
That's, yeah, and telling a story in a way that only theater can, as opposed to, you know, film does realism better than theater does. It just is a fact. So let's do what we do really well, which is allow all these worlds to smash into each other and styles to mix and all of that.
Yeah, that's always a great question of, like, why theater? Why are we doing this live? Like, why does it have to be like that?
Yeah.
So it's great when you find a piece that you're like, oh,
this has to be this way.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So what's the journey been like to get to this point, doing rehearsals now, these past 2 years? What is it?
I mean, it's one thing that's kind of cool for me is my supervisor on this project was also the very first instructor that I had coming here. So there's this nice sort of circling back on. We had our first meeting last week, and he's like, I haven't seen you direct anything in like 2 years. I know. Like, he hasn't been in the rehearsal process with me. So that's kind of fun. But so what brought me here, I guess, is everything. Yeah. Like I said. Small projects in Pinter and Sarah Rule. My first full show here was Betrayal, and then The Importance of Being Earnest last year, which is a whole, you know, journey of styles. But in a way, all of those things have come to this. And I think the two. So I said that language is always the way in for me, and it's almost always the thing that grabs me because that's what you encounter first as well, right? You encounter it on the page. But this play is really lovely because it is also spatial, hugely spatial. It's like very almost architectural. I feel like anything that isn't rigorous text work in the process is about space and movement and relationships of objects in space. And that's something that we started to look at with Betrayal. We did it in the round, but in a triangle round. And the actors never left the space, so there was always this sense of triangulation and the relationships between. And same with Importance of Being Earnest was in an alley. So again, different relationship to the audience. And along a very big, long space that people could play long crosses around. I'm always a fan of that because I think that there's so much storytelling to be done in the walk from me to you, or like that long, in a long cross, or the angle of a moment. So I felt like this show was really an opportunity to bring together my interest in that sort of spatial, sculpting the space kind of thing, and language. Process-wise, I've had the great fortune of working with a production dramaturg, named Rohan Kulkarni, who just finished his MA here last spring. And he and I first collaborated on Betrayal. I asked him into the process sort of halfway through my prep, I would say, because I didn't really know it was a thing, and then oh, this is a resource that's available to me, and we just figured out how to work together, and it was really great to have him on that. So I asked him on this process right away, almost before my show was confirmed, and we met regularly all last winter. We started in January. We met for 3 hours a week all term, and then we've been checking in over the summer . And it's great because what we did was just really meticulously read through the play. It's like we did table work for 3 months before, you know. Yeah. And that was even before I started talking to designers. So by the time I got my design team confirmed and went into the room with designers, I already had a really strong understanding of what the world of the play was and structurally how it worked. We spent a lot of time in looking at different structures, like, you know, tragedy, comedy, romanticism, crisis drama, epic, all these different things to see what pieces are in this play and then diagnostics from there. And that gave it made the design process easy in a way because we could always test the theory against what we knew the play needed to be. And so even if it was like, that's a beautiful idea, but is it what this play needs, or how does it work in what story does the design tell? And I've been very fortunate with my designer, my set and props designer Ksenia, is from Winnipeg as well, so we were we were both home this summer and able to meet over the summer, which is like almost unprecedented, I think. And so we had a really fast sort of rough and ready preliminary session, and then spent the summer revising and came to a design that I feel really good about, because we spent a lot of time talking through the moment to moment and how does the design evolve, and also tell the story, not just sort of like make a backdrop. But,
yeah, that's great. I mean, we very rarely get to work with like an actual production dramaturg. I mean, Canada, there's a lot of, you know, playwriting dramaturgs, which is great. Yeah. But like actually having that opportunity, that's kind of a new.
Yeah, it's something I really think that Canadian theater needs to get on board with. And I realize that there's no money ever, and that's always the problem.
Yes.
But we're so lucky here because we have colleagues who are, you know, in the MA or just fellow colleagues. I've done a little bit of dramaturgy on some of my friends' shows as well. And just to have someone in the room asking the questions, right? Like we every other person involved in the process has someone against whom they can test their theories. Usually it's the director, right? Designers can ask questions, actors ask questions, we support all those different departments. So it seems insane that we would expect the director to just know everything and to be able to, you know, to not. So over the summer there was a moment where I had this idea of like, oh, what happens if, and what does that do if, you know, the actors were to come into the audience, for example. And I thought about it, and it seemed like a sexy idea, and I was about to have a design meeting, and I thought, before I even bring this into the room with the designer, I need to know if this is even remotely doing what I need to do. And I just was able to fire off a quick text to Rohan and go, this is what I'm thinking, I'm not sure, but like, because of this, this, and this, and he's like, yeah, given the parameters that we've established, I don't think it adds anything. And I was like, great. Mm. So I was able to just really quickly have a sounding board. Which, you know, I could have come to that decision myself, but it would have been much more laborious and winding and doubting and to just be able to know that there's somebody who knows what's up.
Well, that's the thing, because sometimes as a director, you just have to try something to see if it works, but that can then eat into your time, especially if you're working on a large project, right?
Totally, yeah. But where we're at in rehearsals right now has been that moment of, like, here's all the prep and trying, you know, wanting to come in as prepared as possible and spending lots of time with my script, and then coming into the room and you know, the first throw at the scene, an actor makes an offer that it never occurred to me, that's brilliant, and it's like, oh great, yeah, and it's not that all that work doesn't matter, it's just that that work can't sub in for actually being in the room, right? So we're just over a week into rehearsals now, and we're almost finished staging the play. I think we'll be done tonight. We did a stumble through of Act One yesterday, and it was really lovely to see the shape and reveal the, you know, mountains of work that's still left to do. But I've got a really great team that are willing to dive in and explore and make lots of good offers. So we've been discovering a lot.
That's great. That first week can be some of the most challenging and rewarding moments.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, and every step of the way, it's like table work is, first of all, it's like first day, okay, what do I do? Like, you know, say this thing, hold the room, get everyone on board. You get through the read, and it's like, oh, good. Wait, now I still have to say smart things because it's table work now. Yeah. And then you get into the flow of table work. It's like, cool, yeah, we're just jamming, we're talking, that's great. And then table work ends, and it's like, oh, my God, now I have to, like, do the thing, and then you get on your feet, and it's like, oh, right, this is where we live, this is what it is, so that's great.
Once the bodies start moving, and once it starts.
Yeah, but it's always those, like, turning points that the crisis of confidence happens, for sure.
You're kind of organizing chaos for the first bit.
And I think, like, the prep helps a lot, because when those questions come up, then it's like, I know the answer to this, or at least I know an answer to it that we can test.
Well, and that's good, because sometimes we don't know the answers as directors, but we know, okay, I know how to get that answer, or I know where we can start to go towards to find it, right?
And that's
kind of need that at times, right?
Totally.
In the process. Well, that's great. Thank you so much for sitting down here and doing that. That's fantastic. Just so everyone knows, God's Ear opens the Tim Center Studio Theater season, and it runs from October 13th to the 22nd. The Dark Day is the Sunday of that run. Tickets can be purchased at the Tim Center box office by phone, email, or online. Links to purchase tickets can be found in the written portion of the interview. So I'd like to thank you once again, Susie, for coming in, and everybody go see the show.